Good morning, early birds. You've caught The Worm, a podcast from Yellowstone Public Radio, rounding up reporting from our newsroom and Montana Public Radio. Today we have updates from both MSUB and UM, reactions to the impeachment inquiry announced yesterday, and a report on glyphosates. It's Wednesday, September 25th. I'm your host, Jess Sheldahl. Montana healthcare professionals met this week to discuss how to support a person's physical and mental health in the midst of reduced services. Rachel Kramer reports from the Integrated Behavioral Health Summit in Bozeman.
Aaron Wernham is a family physician and CEO of the Montana Healthcare Foundation. He says the idea of bringing behavioral healthcare providers into primary care practices in Montana started about 10 years ago. What does it look like for a patient or for a healthcare provider? Like, what does it look like on the ground?
When you walk into the clinic and check in, most of us are used to either filling out some sort of a written questionnaire or having the nurse, while she's checking your vital signs, maybe ask you some questions about how your health is doing. One of the things that's happening at that first part of the visit is we're adding some questions.
Wernham says these added questions about symptoms of depression, anxiety, and addictions aim to treat the whole person. It's a strategy used by many of the 300 attendees at the Integrated Behavioral Health Summit to improve patient care and reduce costs. Wernham says if it seems like the best way to address those issues is that day, the healthcare provider will walk with the patient down the hall to meet with a behavioral healthcare provider.
You just don't want patients to have to go through more work when they've got a lot going on. So if you can come in for a visit, maybe it's for a sore throat, but you're also feeling a little sad or you need a little bit of extra help with alcohol use or whatever it may be, right on that same day you get care.
Wernham says trying to schedule another appointment, figuring out transportation, or taking time off from work make it harder for people to get the help they need. He says the other piece of making integrated care a success is through coordination of providers with a shared database. One of the biggest challenges, he says, is the shortage of people who can provide mental health care services, especially in rural areas rocked by recent closures following funding cuts from the special 2017 legislative session. Bighorn Valley Health Center is working to address this by partnering with the Tribal Community College in Lame Deer to create local training for behavioral health care providers. Sheila Hogan is the director of the Montana Department of Public Health and Human Services.
IBH is really getting traction. It's now implemented to some degree in all of the federally qualified health centers, the majority of the hospitals, and you are all working hard every day to make that happen.
With Yellowstone Public Radio News, I'm Rachel Kramer.
Billings experienced a 75% increase in violent crime from 2012 to 2017. That increase prompted the Billings Chamber of Commerce to focus on public safety during its annual meeting yesterday. I found out more.
The Billings Chamber advocated for better building design as a way to reduce costly crimes of opportunity like robbery or graffiti. Mark Johnson is one of three people in Montana and Wyoming certified by the National Institute of Crime Prevention in crime prevention through environmental design practices.
So those of you that do not know what SEPTED is, the four principles are access control, natural surveillance, territorial reinforcement, and maintenance.
About 300 business owners, community leaders, and members of the Billings Police and Fire Departments listened to Johnson's presentation on SEPTED. Johnson used Riverstone Health Center as an example of a building which applied the SEPTED principles by having a well-lit parking lot and entrance, as well as maintained landscaping. Ironically, he used the Billings Chamber of Commerce as an example of a building that could use improvements, such as getting rid of blind spots created by a wall in the back of the building. A study done by the Southern California Injury Prevention Research Center at UCLA found that SEPTED is an effective approach to reducing robbery. Daniel Brooks with the Billings Chamber of Commerce is expected to receive national SEPTED certification in order to help assess businesses in Billings by the end of the year. For Yellowstone Public Radio News, I'm Jess Sheldahl.
Montana State University Billings released the strategic plan this week that will guide its vision for the next 7 years. Kayla DeRoche has more.
Chancellor Dan Edelman joined the campus last year. Speaking to about 70 staff members and some students Monday, he outlined the university's plan to raise funds, increase student enrollment, and foster a stronger campus culture over the next few years.
This strategic plan is not something that's going to sit on a shelf like the last one did. This strategic plan is going to be a living, breathing document where we're going to be looking at it and changing it and updating it.
The strategy outlines five objectives with staff assigned to oversee implementation of each sub-objective. So, for example, a staff member is tasked with strengthening ties to the Native American, veteran, and Hispanic communities as part of the broader goal to form partnerships in the area. Edelman has said he wants to increase enrollment to 6,000 students in the next 5 years. Last year, MSUB counted enrollment at 4,300 students. The university plans to release this year's number later in September. Kayla DeRoche, Yellowstone Public Radio News.
For the eighth year in a row, fall enrollment has dropped at the University of Montana. Despite the slide, campus officials say they're encouraged by what they're seeing. Montana Public Radio's Edward O'Brien explains.
The University of Montana announced Tuesday that overall enrollment is down just over 1% from fall semester of 2018. Enrollment figures show 125 fewer students this fall than last year, with just shy of 10,000 students enrolled at UM. UM's chief enrollment officer, Kathy Cole, says that enrollment dip came as a surprise to no one.
With the bigger graduating class that we had in the spring, and then we graduated about another 400 students this summer, we knew overall enrollment was going to dip a little bit, and we'd planned for it both on an educational side and on the budget side, so we're well within our parameters there.
UM's undergrad enrollment has plummeted by over 30% since 2011. Enrollment is closely tied to budgeting. Cole says the university is working hard to attract more first-time freshmen to campus. There are almost 3% more of them attending UM this semester than at this time last year.
And that indicates we're getting our message out there to the right students and that they are reciprocating by coming to an institution that will give them a tomorrow-proof education.
What's more, Cole says UM is doing a better job of holding on to those freshmen into their sophomore year.
And this year we were able to increase that by 3 full percentage points. We went from 68.4% to 71.4%, and that's an incredible boost to the retention.
The university released two sets of enrollment numbers Tuesday. One includes both paid and pending students. The other metric, the one used for this story, includes only those students who are fully enrolled and paid up. UM says that's a more accurate reflection of enrollment, and officials intend to fully adopt that census method by next fall. Bozeman's Montana State University, meanwhile, recorded an enrollment this fall of 16,766 students. That's about 140 fewer than last autumn's record enrollment. Edward O'Brien, Montana Public Radio.
A former employee of the Montana Department of Corrections alleges she lost her job after refusing sexual advances by the agency director. Montana Public Radio's Corin Cates Carney reports.
The lawsuit filed in Lewis and Clark District Court late last week by Adrian Cotton alleges she was approached by Director Reginald Michael in what she understood as a quid pro quo of sexual favors for career advancement. Carolyn Bright, Communications Director for the Montana Department of Corrections, says Director Michael denies the allegations of sexual harassment and retaliation. The court filing alleges that on a drive to Billings in the fall of 2017, with just Michael and Cotton in the car, Michael told Cotton that he had, quote, a history of subordinates requesting to engage in sexual activity with him, unquote. The lawsuit then says immediately after, Michael asked Cotton about her career goals and if she had an interest in the deputy director position at the department, which would soon become available. Cotton's job as the agency's government relations officer was cut during the department's restructuring last year. The Montana Television Network reported last December that former DOC employees called the restructuring within the agency retaliation against people who questioned Director Michael. That MTN report included allegations of sexual harassment. Marissa Perry, a spokesperson for Governor Steve Bullock, said in an emailed statement, "The governor's office takes allegations of sexual harassment very seriously," adding that when the allegations first came to light, an investigation was launched. The investigation found Cotton's complaint was unsubstantiated. Cotton has filed a complaint with the Human Rights Bureau and is appealing its findings. I'm Corin Cates Carney, Montana Public Radio News.
Montana's congressional delegation is reacting in the wake of House Speaker Nancy Pelosi's announcement yesterday afternoon that the House will move forward with an official impeachment inquiry of President Donald Trump. On Tuesday morning, Republican Senator Steve Daines tweeted, quote, "impeachment, obsession," unquote, over a gif of a character from the popular TV show The Office rolling his eyes. A spokesperson told YPR that Daines, quote, "believes the Democrats sound like a broken record with their 2+ years of impeachment threats." She added, "now isn't the time to speculate about Trump's alleged conversations with the Ukrainian president, and Daines looks forward to hearing the facts." Speaking at a House Judiciary Committee hearing last week, Republican Congressman Greg Gianforte chastised Democrats for investigating the president over addressing what he called the crisis on our border and episodes of mass violence.
But instead, this committee has been taken over with impeachment fever. And Madam Chair, if you have to investigate something, if your fever just won't break, maybe you could bring Inspector General Horowitz from the Justice Department to discuss the actions of the FBI, CIA, and special counsel. Maybe you could do more than take a shallow look at the deep state.
Montana's Democratic Senator John Tester said he's disturbed by reports the president pressured the leader of a foreign country to investigate his political opponent. Tester wrote, "the administration's withholding a report from a co-equal branch of government is unprecedented and dangerous." He added, "next steps should wait until the Inspector General's report on the whistleblower's complaint." Governor Steve Bullock, who's running for the Democratic presidential nomination in 2020, said in a campaign statement that if the president abused his office and jeopardized American national security for his own personal gain, then the House needs to impeach him. Trump yesterday called the allegations against him ridiculous and a witch hunt. He contended he did nothing wrong and is promising to release a transcript of the call that triggered Pelosi's announcement today. Earlier this month, a second Wyoming man filed a federal lawsuit against the agribusiness giant Monsanto. It's one of more than 18,000 lawsuits claiming the world's most widely used pesticide causes cancer and that Monsanto has tried to cover up the risks. Rachel Kramer reports some agricultural experts in Montana are concerned that growing public scrutiny could affect trade and take away a tool for farmers. Others say they're already losing that tool as weeds become more resistant.
Near the town of Vida in northeast Montana, Trevor Schock is driving around the 10,000 acres he farms with his dad and a hired hand. It's the end of August, and an immense blue sky presses down on the patchwork of brown, yellow, and golden fields. Schock points out a harvested field where they sprayed weed killer 2 days ago.
So you can see the weeds are already starting. They don't have a deep green color. They've got more of a limey, going on yellow color. The edges are starting to kind of burn up a little bit.
Like many farmers, Schock rotates fields in and out of production to give the soil a rest and let it absorb more moisture. But he says there's a trade-off. By letting a field go fallow for a year, Schock says weeds can take over.
You can either till it, you know, disturb the ground and rip it up, which has kind of been shown to be not the greatest thing for the soils, or you can spray chemicals on it. Glyphosate would be the primary chemical that we use for that.
Farmers have been using glyphosate for the last 4 decades, primarily in the form of Monsanto's signature product Roundup. It's fairly cheap, and industry experts consider it safer than some other pesticides on the market. But over the last 5 years, it has become part of a contentious debate in courtrooms and international trade. In 2015, an arm of the World Health Organization classified glyphosate as probably carcinogenic to humans. It sparked thousands of lawsuits from people with non-Hodgkin lymphoma who'd used Roundup, and Monsanto has had to pay millions of dollars in damages for 3 civil cases. Following the WHO report, the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency and the European Food Safety Authority decided to review glyphosate again. But they concluded glyphosate is not likely to be carcinogenic.
We need to really pay attention to the old adage that the dose makes the poison.
That's Cecil Tharp, Montana State University's Extension Pesticide Education Specialist.
There has been a few studies that did show glyphosate may be associated with non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. But when looked at closer, these associations were quite weak. Most of the studies did not find these associations.
He says when WHO classified glyphosate as a probable carcinogen, it wasn't quantifying the concentration it would take to cause cancer, whereas the EPA does. For example, WHO puts glyphosate in the same category as red meat. Why? Because there are associations between eating red meat and colon cancer. That doesn't mean a vegetarian who eats a steak will automatically get cancer. But there are other complications that have made it hard for people to trust glyphosate. In the EPA's reevaluation of the chemical, the agency looked at evidence from some private studies that were paid for by Monsanto. And during a court case in 2017, internal company emails showed how Monsanto tried to recruit outside scientists and reporters to defend the safety of glyphosate and discredit WHO. At the same time, the Environmental Working Group released test results showing glyphosate residues in Cheerios and other popular cereals and snacks. The news resulted in a big public backlash. Pesticide education specialist Cecil Tharp says whether or not something causes cancer, public opinion matters. Some of the European markets that import American grain are even more suspicious of glyphosate.
There is increased scrutiny on glyphosate. Now, that's a fact. And it's changing the market somewhat, where foreign markets now are testing for glyphosate residual at a much higher incidence.
Glyphosate testing isn't required in the U.S. unless the grain is organic or headed to a foreign market. Ben Thomas is the director of the Montana Department of Agriculture.
When it comes to other countries, that's largely a partnership of private testing facilities and the importing countries themselves.
Thomas says there are international limits for glyphosate residues on food products, but some countries have started adopting their own standards. Last year, Italy cut back on imports of Canadian wheat because it had trace amounts of glyphosate.
The bottom line is it's going to be disruptive to trade. So as we see these levels being set differently in a manner that's not based on science, that's not based on protecting human health, it's going to limit our options for exporting.
He says he's concerned increasing public pressure could also take away an important tool farmers use to manage weeds. Back at the farm near Vida, Trevor Schock points out some green plants.
Probably in the last 10 years, we've been noticing glyphosate-resistant weeds are becoming more and more of a thing. Kochia in particular, and then seems like the newer weeds, the hawksbeard and the mare's tail, it kind of has a natural glyphosate resistance, especially when it's larger.
Schock says he and his neighbors recognize that they'll have to find an alternative to pesticides with glyphosate in the future. Perhaps the weeds themselves will be a faster game changer than changing market demands and regulations. With Yellowstone Public Radio News, I'm Rachel Kramer.
And that's what's happening in Montana today. Check in with Montana Public Radio's Montana Evening News for updates on the news of the day. For Yellowstone Public Radio News, I'm Jess Sheldahl. We'll have another episode of The Worm for you early birds tomorrow morning.
The Worm is produced by Jess Sheldahl for Yellowstone Public Radio. Theme music composed and recorded by Zach Jones at Rapscallion Recording. Meadowlark Call captured by Jay McGowan for the Macaulay Library. Partial funding for The Worm is provided by the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication on issues, trends, and values of importance to Montana. More information about The Worm is available at ypradio.org.